Be here today to introduce our speaker. It's a real pleasure to introduce him. How many of you ever heard of the company Selection Research Incorporated? How many hands go up? Well, I see one. No surprise. There was a man by the name of Dr. Don Clifton, who was a psychology professor at the University of Nebraska. And this was back in the 1960s. And he did a few studies for the president of the university at that time, who was a name you may remember, Cliff Hardin, who then went on to be Secretary of Agriculture. And one such study, Dr. Hardin said, you know, do you ever think about starting a business? And it clicked. It clicked with Dr. Don Clifton, and he started a business in 1969 called Selection Research Incorporated. There's another guy that formed a business by the name of Dr. George Gallup. Okay, 1935, when Dr. Gallup decided he was getting a little older and wanted to sell his company, guess who bought it? Dr. Don Clifton. And that time, in 1988, they changed the name of SRI to Gallup. Today, under our speaker's leadership, Gallup has 40 offices. Today, Gallup has 40 offices in 30 countries around the world. They're headquartered in Washington, D.C. They have about 2,300 associates. 1,000 of those are in the original area of Nebraska and Omaha and Lincoln. Some of the cities nationally that they are in include London, Shanghai, Berlin, Singapore, Sydney, Dubai, Bangalore, and Bangkok. Is that enough variety for you? They have 4 divisions. You're most familiar with Gallup because of the polling, but also Gallup University, Gallup Press, and Gallup Poll, which conducts more than 1,000 interviews each day in the United States on land and cell phones, 350 days a year. Under Jim's leadership, since he took over as CEO in 1988, gross billings have increased 15 times. Think of that. What does Gallup do? Well, a number of things. It conducts leadership and strategy-based consulting, includes customer and employee research and training for financial institutions, healthcare companies, government, and retail. They have a lot of famous brands as customers. In fact, in thinking about several of their customers, we've had the CEO of that company as a speaker one time or another, including one we are going to have this year. The Worldpool surveys 160 countries, people there, and it reports on economy, education, leadership, well-being, and politics. I think Jim's dad, Dr. Don Clifton, is up there somewhere smiling down on his son and what he's been able to create in the way of leadership to build this company. I got to give you a couple personal notes. I like to do that. First of all, there's a book, and I probably am going to tell you about this later. Here's a book. The author, Jim Clifton. What's the title? The Coming Jobs War. I have read it twice. The first time I was so scared I put it down. I thought, you know, I'm going to go back and read this because I probably missed something. Believe me, it's a good read, and I imagine Jim will have a few comments about that. But if you read the book or have read it, you will note in the front it says, this book is dedicated to the girl at United Gate 4. F4. United Gate F4 at O'Hare International Airport. It was terrible weather in Chicago. Flight cancellations. I don't remember whether it was ice, snow, rain, but all of the above. And Jim was trying to get out of O'Hare at United Gate F4. Well, there happened to be a young lady there as well that was trying to do the same thing. Susan, first name. Susan was a single mom. She was a marketing person for Polaroid. She went to trade shows. That was her job. And they struck up a conversation. And later on, Jim's pretty persistent guy, as you'll find out. He contacted Susan and said, how about coming to Omaha for a date? And she turned him down. Jim, you're not shaking your head yes or no. Am I okay thus far? Seriously. But Jim's persistence paid off, his sister told me. And eventually they were married in 1983. So that's how Jim met Susan. And Jim went on to adopt Nicole, and today Nicole's the mother of Jim's grandson, Max. In addition, Jim and Susan have a son and a daughter as well, and I'm sorry Susan couldn't be here today and I could introduce her as well. But remember the girl at United Gate F4 if you're ever at O'Hare. You might want to go check it out and say, oh, I remember this gate. Okay, I've said enough. I want to get Jim up here to talk with us and give him as much time as possible with Q&A included. As usual, some of our directors will be circulating the audience trying to pick up your Q&A cards. And so right now, let's please give a big Forum Club welcome to our 28th season opening speaker, Mr. Jim Clifton. Jim?
Thank you, David. I got to tell you something. I live in Washington, D.C., but I was born and raised in Nebraska. And I didn't, and so he has a lot of Nebraska ties too, but when you're in Nebraska and there's a story that follows you all the way up and down the coast and it gets told so many times, I thought maybe that David was going to tell that. But so my dad taught school at the University of Nebraska for 20 years. I went to school at the University of Nebraska too. My wife's actually from farm country out in western Nebraska, but Maybe you've heard this before. This isn't a joke. This is actually a story. But Nebraska was playing Oklahoma, and this is the one that follows me all over the place. Big game. It was a Thanksgiving Day game. And if you're a Nebraskan, that's your whole year just headed to that day, this years ago. ABC was in town, games in Lincoln, Nebraska. And they're interviewing a star running back at Nebraska. I'm not going to say his name because you might be able to figure it out, but And he's sitting there, and she's interviewing him. And by the way, he's got his helmet on his lap. And if you don't know this, Nebraska has just a white helmet and just one block red end. That's all it is, and he's holding that. And the lady from ABC Sports asked him a personal question. She wanted to do something kind of sensitive. But so she said to him, if the N on your helmet didn't stand for Nebraska, what might it stand for? He thought, he really wanted to get this right. And he said, I'd have to say knowledge. So, I just want you to know that everything I say comes with a warning label. I went to school at a place where we're not positive how knowledge is spelled. Well, you guys, I was telling some people this last night, but I'm 61 now, but I just turned 60, and I started looking back over the last 30, 35 years, and I was thinking, what an unbelievable time to be an American. You know, the run that we've had over the last 30, 35 years is probably the most spectacular time in the history of mankind for human development. I mean, it has been absolutely extraordinary. There is no place in the world like the United States. And when you're 60, you've seen 25% of it. Think of the difference in being an American compared to being a Chinese. You know, where they measure in dynasties and thousands of years. My mother's still alive. She was a pioneer lady. Her dad was a homesteader. Not great-grandfather, just grandfather. Sit with her. She's 90 years old. And I was thinking, geez. She's seen 40% of it. We have living people. If you go back, there'd just be three other Jim Cliftons, and you got founding fathers. Well, like a lot of you, I started looking forward and I started wondering what the next 30 years is going to be like. And then I put together a whole team of people, economists, Gallup people, and I thought I'm just going to try to figure this out. I want to tell you those results. I'm only going to give you, there's one thing as American leaders that we're doing that's wrong. We're making a huge, huge strategic error. I just want to straighten that out, and maybe you'll have some questions. So, a little over 30 years ago, I'm watching TV, And there's a panel of economists that are on, both left and right leaning. And the question was, where will the United States GDP, remember GDP is, you know, it's kind of like the sales, but it's also production. So if you said, what's the sales of a company? If you say, what's the sales of America? It would be, it's basically GDP. So the assignment they had was tell where the American GDP would be in 30 years. Let's just say now. Actually, about 5 years ago, but let's just say now. Every single one of them predicted that Japan and Germany would eclipse our GDP because they had, some of the guys that are my age are nodding their heads, they said that they because they would have superior manufacturing. And they said that right now, America would fall to third in GDP. They said Japan would be at about $5 trillion. They said Germany would be at about, oh, 3.75 trillion. And America would be at about $3.5 trillion. So here we are. How'd they do? Well, not too bad. They got Japan right. Japan is 5. Germany is almost 4. They had us at 3.5. You guys, we bowed up to $15 trillion. They missed that one by over $10 trillion. But you see, there's a lesson in there, and that means that there's a spirit that actually counts. The next year doesn't just follow a linear regression equation to the next year. As leaders, when we get wound up, we can change things. You know, Tom Brokaw has that thing. I love it. But he calls it the greatest generation. That was my dad and uncles, and my aunt even built, she really was Rosie the Riveter. But we've kind of forgot about the baby boomers. When I'm talking to an MBA class, I say to the deans, why don't you teach this? Because the baby boomers went right back out, and so the greatest generation beat the Japanese and Germans in Kinetic War. And then they came right back. But the baby boomers had to wipe them out in economic wars. And they did. But you see, whatever happened during that time, if we don't open a can of that right now, the next 30 years isn't going to be very, very good. What I did was I put a team of economists together, and I said, let's do it over again. Where are we going to be in 30 years? So they ran their numbers. Here's right now the total sales of the world, total GDP, is $60 trillion. It's a really important leadership number for us all to know. $60 trillion. Here's another thing to know. 25% of it is U.S. We're $15 trillion. I don't know why the word exceptionalism got politicized, but if you don't think that performance has been exceptional, you're hallucinating or smoking or if you're in Colorado, we could be smoking a joint today, but you're high on something. It means that we have sort of built out the whole world economy and invented everything. That's what you have to do when you only have 300 million people to be 25% of the entire economy. So what I did was I averaged what the economists said throughout the outliers. In 30 years, the world's GDP will be $200 trillion. So we're going to go from 60 to 200. This is what you need to know in all the places, in all the institutions that you influence. It means that $140 trillion of new equity, stock, customers, good jobs, sales, revenue, $140 trillion of new stuff is going to be rained on the whole world by the god of GDP. But what's so important is who gets that gets to be leader of the free world. It's really that simple. You know, the United States of America is leader of the free world for two reasons. One thing is, you know, our military is so much bigger and stronger than everybody else. You know why we can do that? Because we have so much money. But the biggest power we probably have overseas, if you ever talk to people who negotiate treaties, is our economic power. So you can negotiate for as long as you want. Then when you get tired, you can say, well, how about if we just shut everything off? And then they start saying, yes, 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 yes. What about when all that goes away? So I asked the team to say, okay, now America's at $15 trillion. Where will she be in 30 years? The answer to that one is $30 trillion. It doesn't work. $30 trillion is too small. This whole country, if you can imagine, and I know some of you are from Detroit, but you know the problems Detroit is having, or what about Sacramento? Just imagine that coast to coast. We are on perfect track, 15 to 30. Here's one. I said, what about China? You guys know these numbers, but they're about 5 to 6 trillion right now. 80 trillion. Oh my gosh, that doesn't work well at all. That clearly makes them leader of the free world. By the way, I want to put in right now, just because it gets kind of dark, you go, oh my God, no more, no more. If somebody said, Dave, do you want China's cards or do you want America's cards? You definitely want America's cards. We're still holding better cards, but where we sit right now doesn't look perfect. So the question is, if you just do the linear regression, we're on our way to a very, very different relationship with the rest of the world. But I want to give you a couple of examples. You know, if you just take military, and it's been about $800 billion, not counting the wars. So when they're talking about cutting her back, you might cut her back $200 or $300 billion. But if you put in Iraq and Afghanistan, you get up to about $1 trillion. That's more than the next 25 countries put together that they spend on defense. So we ought to have something pretty big. I had I won't say his name, but I had a four-star general in my office in Washington. I always say four-star. I didn't know this until I lived in Washington. Four-star is so far ahead of three-star, it is incredible. And three-star, if there's a two-star, I mean, they got to, like, run get sandwiches and that kind of thing. But I said to him, General, I said, just think of me as your customer. We spent $1 trillion on all this weaponry and all this magic stuff. What do we get? What's the promise? I didn't know there was an answer this clear. Maybe some of you know this. But he said, we guarantee that in the event of world war, we can annihilate the enemy on three fronts in the first 24 hours of war. Total devastation. I thought that, trillion's a lot, but I thought that sounded like a pretty good buy. But you guys, you think about every place that State Department where people go, where you always have that one. You got a big black bull behind the door, maybe, and you say, well, we're never going to open the door. I know, but having that big black bull behind the door makes an awful lot of difference. But that means that if we were suddenly at war with China, Russia, who would the third one be? Canada? I don't know. Well, whoever. A lot of oppression up there. I guess that was a joke only for me. Only for me. But, you know, my wife called me, Susan called me, and she goes, I was out of town, but she goes, the space shuttle's coming by. It's on a 747. We live right on the Potomac. And she goes, it's coming right by the window. She goes, I feel like I could reach out and touch it. Listen, you guys, I'm all... I love the military. I love the space exploration and all that. That thing's another $1 trillion. You know, talk about going out into space. You know how far we've gotten in space? You know how far James Van Allen got Pioneer 10 out? 8.4 billion miles. Now, by the way, somebody might correct you and say, you must mean million. It's not, it's billion. Sun's out 90 million miles. He got Pioneer 10 out 100 times farther than the sun. But you know why you can do all of that? Because 25% of all the money for 7 billion people is ours. But it's because we have such a different relationship. Our money continues up until very recently that we had so much to spend on human development than everybody else. You know, healthcare is one, $2.5 trillion. You know how big Russia's whole economy is? Just about 1.2, you see. We spend more on military than those guys have to run their whole damn country. All their money isn't even as much as we spend on military. You know, India, some of us, when we would come back years ago, remember, you guys did this too, from India and China, let's say it was 10, 15 years ago, remember what we would say? I don't think China's the one to watch. I think it's India. Remember we'd say that at our country club or wherever? Boy, were we wrong. You know, India just can't get they're increasing at a decreasing rate, which is the problem. But India's whole GDP is only about 1.3 trillion. You see what I mean? We spend twice as much on health care for only 300 million people that they have for their whole country to do everything. That's how far out we've got. So this is the biggest finding that we had. I just want to lay that on you. I'm going to look at my clock here. I got wound up. Okay. Just a minute. I'm going to get a... Hold on just 1 second. I'm just going to grab that iced tea or something. Yeah, thanks a lot. And when I say this, I don't want anybody to throw a tomato or anything like that, but Dr. Gallup had a thing where he said, if democracy is about the will of the people, somebody should go find out what that will is. That was it. But his whole point was, if we don't know what's on the minds of people, leadership will get off on the wrong track, and the more we manage, because our premises are wrong, the worse we make everything. This country has one premise so wrong right now, and it's the expectation of innovation. By the way, I can say this, I sell innovation, that's Gallup's whole thing. We think innovation creates jobs. Stay with me. So what we do is we put $100 billion into innovation, and then we stand back and we go, did any jobs come out, Harvey? Beth, did you see? Not yet. Well, then you better put another $100 billion in. Put another $100 billion in. About any jobs now? Nope. I got a friend that's president of the university. He went out and bulldozed the state fair. Fine with me. The people looked like hell that were going to it anyway. But he bulldozed it and made it into an innovation center. I know he stands out there and he keeps watching for jobs to come out. Any yet? Nope. We have the wrong expectation for that. Here's what nobody knows, and I mean, this will sound so simple, it's hard to quite deliver it. Innovation has no value whatsoever until a customer is standing next to it. And nobody knows that. I was out at dinner. You guys know who Vint Cerf is? He's pretty much the father of the internet. So he's sitting in Washington, D.C., worked for DARPA, the Defense Department, and he got the packets to fly around on fiber optic, so he'd set up his, but it was for defense. The internet is probably the biggest part of that incredible rise that we had in economics and in human development, just the internet. Huge, huge game changer. And this isn't a very complimentary story about Vint, but it tells you it's true. He's sitting at dinner, my wife here, his wife here. I said, how long did you have it before? And he says, well, he says, I was just sitting there working with it. And he said a U.S. senator came over and he'd heard about it and he wanted to see it. He was real interested in technology. He looked at it and he said, holy cow, this could be incredible. He said, do you mind if I go back to the Senate? Pass an act where we take this technology and throw it out to commerce, see what entrepreneurs can do with it. Vint said back to the senator, and this is the story Vint told me, and this is one part that's not very common. He said to the guy, well, fine with me, but I don't see what value anybody will have for it. I mean, that conversation is far bigger than Watson, come here, I need you. Think of that conversation. But what if that senator hadn't come over? We would have had innovation sitting there, innovation extraordinaire that created jobs all around the world and changed mankind if it hadn't been thrown out to commerce. By the way, do you know who the U.S. senator is? I'm the only guy in the world that tells a nice story about Al Gore. I'm not the only guy that doesn't like him, but that's just the way that's the path that calf followed. I was sitting at my desk, and this lady in Washington calls me, and she says, I need you to come over to the Academy of Sciences and give a speech. And I said, when? She said, at 11:30 today. And I looked and it was 9. She's got a lot on me, too, so I have to kind of be careful. I have to do what she says. Not that kind of thing on me, just nothing. But anyway, so I said, yeah, I'll come over. I said, who's the group? And she said, it's the presidents of America's biggest laboratories, NASA, NIH, MIT, CDC, and that kind. It's a real nice group of about maybe just 35 people. By the way, when you have those 35 in there, the institutes that they run, there's no place in the world that has innovation like that. They have imaginary innovation in India. They have imaginary innovation in Middle East and all over the place. That's the most valuable innovation there is. I said, what do you want me to talk? She goes, they're going back for more innovation. I want more money. They're going to go ask Congress for another $100 billion or something. She goes, I want them to tell them your theory. And I said, well, that should go over pretty well. So I went over and I said, look, you guys, I said, you know what I'm going to say. But I said, before I say anything, let me ask a question. I want a show of hands. So it's only a group of like these three, kind of like those three tables. I said, I want a show of hands. How many of you have inventions in your laboratories right now that are ready to go but just need a customer? And with God as my witness, every hand went up. But you see, we've got supply and demand all inverted. Now, why would that happen? Why would Americans? One of the things I like about Americans is we always get it figured out at some point. We are the best in the world at intellectual development, and nobody's close. Now, I know we've got our problems with urban schools, and all of us are a big part of that. But if you take 1,000 kids, and you tell educational psychologists, line them up by IQ, line them up smartest to dumbest, they'll just go boom, 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 and they'll be high, and they'll be near perfect agreement. We can just nail that because we're the best in the world at that. Then what we do is we take that top that top 1, 2, 3%, send them to, I don't know where, Georgia Tech, and then on to MIT, and then they go on to CDC or NIH or like some of these brilliant kids that we have here. We really know how to develop intellectual strength. By the way, I was just looking at the Economist put out the top 30 MBA schools. So remember, it's London-based, right? So it's not... Of the top 30 MBA schools, those are very important institutions, 20 of them are in the United States of America, 9 in Europe, 1 in Canada, but this is important, 0 in China, 0 in India, 0 in South America, Latin America, 0 in the Middle East. Our university system that we have in this country doesn't get enough recognition. I mean, they all have their own. They have all kinds of problems and arguments with their states and everything else. But that really works. China just put out a list of the top 100 universities in the world. China did. Beijing wanted to get it right. They had a bunch of, variables. And anyway, only 50 of them are America, and only 2 are Chinese. When we got in a lot of trouble, what we did is we went to what we do very, very best. And we said, let's solve this with intellectual strength. What we should have said is, what really happened during that 3 years was a spectacular moment of entrepreneurship. We missed it. We misread the game film, and we got the wrong strategy. I'm just looking here. Have you guys ever heard of... Yeah, of course you have. Dave, you must know Wayne Huizenga. Yeah, there's a lot of Ohio. I love that guy. So he's I was going to say garbage man. What do you want to call that? But you know, he had a truck. Okay, whatever the title. But anyway, here's his big idea. Let's get some more trucks and let's have a hell of a garbage service, trash collection service. Well, you know how it ends up. It turns out to be a Fortune 500 company, a great stock company. You know, it's a great place to work. They got green energy, and it's just it's a hell of a thing. And he built it in one lifetime. You wonder if people look at that and go, oh, why didn't I get that idea? You know why? It wasn't that good of an idea. You know what his next one was? I did the research on it a long time ago. He thought it'd be a hell of a thing to rent videos out of strip malls, so you'd rent the video and then bring it back again. You know what that one is? Blockbuster. I did the research. It wasn't that good of an idea. It's okay. By the way, I did research, David, a long time ago for bankers. And this is so long ago, but the bankers would close their banks at 1 or 2 o'clock. And the research I did said, you ought to leave them open so people that have jobs can actually use them. That was a big breakthrough. Those are the kind of breakthroughs you can get with a guy like me. But Wayne's idea was somewhere about right in there. Now, that thing's had a great run. Of course, technology changes and all that, but that was his second one. But I've always wondered, what did we do as Americans? Did we look and go, oh, why didn't I get that Blockbuster idea? But you see how we misread it? You know, his third idea was selling used cars. Oh, why didn't I get that one? So he built three Fortune 500 companies. What you have with Wayne is a person that God built differently than everybody else. But we don't have any way to test for it. I was going to tell you one more. I did the research for Ted Turner, and his idea was 24-hour news, kind of the same thing like with banks. Wasn't that great of an idea? The determination that a guy like that has is so strong that they can make almost any idea work. I'll just land this point, and then I'll wrap up, and we have some questions. Until we make the institution of entrepreneurial development as intentional as we have intellectual development. So when we have 1,000 kids and we can line them up by their ability to create a business, start a company, create a customer, we'll never make the comeback and we'll go from 30 to 60. If we do make an institution of entrepreneurial development as intentional as we have intellectual development, there's no limit to what we can become. I think we could go to 50 trillion. I think we could go to 100 trillion. And it really is a playoff game, I think, between us and China. But if we get that fixed, then our cards are definitely much better. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. I feel fortunate that I got to know Don Clifton, Jim's father, and our bank wasn't open 9 to 2. We were open on Saturdays and Sundays as well. Okay? Is that all right?
Good job.
All right. Okay. We have a few questions, and one, I'm going to add a couple things to it. There are a couple questions about students. What do we need to help them to help us have a better society going forward? That's kind of the brunt of a couple questions I have.
I'll say this to these kids here. Another mistake that we're making with leadership development is we try to turn you into somebody else. So at my age, when I would go to leadership training, they always try to turn me into Jack Welch or Colin Powell. Do you know who Jack Welch is, your kids? Okay. But he's probably the greatest manager of his time, or at least the most respected, if you don't think he's the greatest. But I know both those guys. They don't have anything in common at all, the two of them don't. They got nothing in common. They're just great leaders. But be careful, because people will try to turn you into somebody else and it makes you worse. But here's the difference. You have strengths that are very unique to yourself. If you analyze your own strengths and write them down and then present yourself, see your whole world through those strengths, everything's different. Here's what nobody will tell you. Weaknesses never develop, and people will try to make them develop. You shouldn't be late. You should pay your bills on time. You should do a bunch of things like that. Weaknesses don't develop. Strengths develop infinitely. And so if you can become your own best analyst and write those down, here's what happens, though. It changes your confidence in your self-efficacy. So when you present yourself, whether it's to get a job or whatever you're doing, and it's with your and you're doing it through your strengths, your confidence and power, you get cognitive expansion, everything changes. But I think if you said, what's the one single most important thing, I would say, know your strengths and present and see your whole world through them.
I would like to mention one thing that I didn't say in my introduction. One thing that took place when Dr. Don Clifton and George Gallup got together. This couldn't be in a merger agreement, but they kind of had a gentleman's agreement that this company would remain nonpartisan. And if you look at the way the activities of Gallup have been carried out, I think you would have to say that since the acquisition, they've lived up to that. Now, I have a lot of questions, political questions, and I'm not going to ask most of them because I think that puts Jim in a little more difficult situation.
But I don't care.
I'm going to ask one. Here's one question. It came from two different people. Who would be a better president of the United States, Obama or Don Trump?
You know,
I got to have a little leavening, Jim.
I'm going to answer that. But I think I said this last night to a few of you. This is really interesting to me. But the president of the United States matters, but not in this comeback as much as you think. I think it's only a small percent. So Romney obviously is much more pro-business than the president. I don't know if it would have made that much difference. I know there's a lot of engineers and business people, Six Sigma and Lean and all that. You know what you look for? You look for variation. That's where your big discoveries are. But the variation in cities in America is we did in our project, is incredible. I'll just do one real fast for you. Texas and New York, both big states, capital, Austin and Albany, and neither city has any ports, there's no reason that they should be great or good. They're both capitals. Austin has as much or more energy, pound for pound, per person, let's just say per person, than maybe any city in the world right now. That thing is really growing. Austin, or Albany, you can just damn near shut the lights off on the place. But what's the difference? The difference is, and a whole bunch of you are this, but the local tribe leaders have different outcomes. And the more they care about their city, the more unusual the outcome. But if you have people that don't care very much, don't have much influence, don't have strong hands, you can have great variation. But if this whole country had a whole bunch of Austin, Texas, and I know Nashville's going great, and I know Silicon Valley, although the state of Texas may drop off the face of the earth economically, that one's still going real well. What'd I say? California. But Silicon Valley. But if every city had the energy that Austin, Texas does. Omaha has a lot of energy right now too, but that energy is either going up or down. But if we just fixed all those cities, we'd re-win the world within the next just the next 5 to 10 years.
The unemployment rate there is between 3% and 4%, and never went above 5 or so during the big recession. It just comes from a number of different areas on that low unemployment rate. We're running out of time almost, Jim. I want to kind of consolidate a couple. There are several questions about how the media influences polls, how polls influence voting, whether those polls do have a great influence on voting or not. But just, if you wouldn't mind, touch on polls in general, what influence they might have on people's thought when they go to the voting booth.
Well, I mean, you get asked... They might have made some difference years ago, but whatever difference they make now would be so small, because we're just so used to them. You see, so there are so many polls right now. This is a funny thing for me to say. We're not actually political pollsters, so we don't work for Democrats, Republicans, and all that kind of thing. But so if you see a Gallup poll that says somebody's way ahead or somebody's way behind, I think the question is, does that cause you to vote more or less? I don't know. But there's a consideration in there, and I don't think it's the polls that do it, but if you're in 40 states, right now, 40 different states, your vote doesn't count because we're so divided as a country. The margins are so big. I mean, if you live in California, Oregon, Washington, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, all those places, your vote doesn't count. I don't think polls change that at all. But the question about polls, and I think just about journalism in general, is just this: what are you going to keep a secret? And, you know, we live in a society where we say we want to know every single thing we can. You know, right now there's something that's pretty interesting to me, but it's called content analysis. You know what that is? That's where you just take all the conversations that we had, and then you just count the words, and then you do, some kind of super cybernetic analysis on it, and you can find out not only, you know, the number of words that we all use, me even fewer than you, isn't that many. So it's not that hard to just do a taxonomy of all of the words and then everything that we thought. So the question is, do we want to present content analysis or polls or whatever? I think the answer as Americans, it's always got to be yes. We got to keep ourselves, our openness out ahead of the whole world.
Okay, two quick last questions. Number one, I have several cards that are interested in the composition of our population. One's 20 years out, one's 30 years out, one's 40 years out. And I think that's what it's getting at, of course, is changing demographics of our population in the United States as well. Could you comment on that? Just pick one number. Good, sir. 20, 30, 40 years were the three that came forward.
I don't know. I always, you really need to segment or bifurcate the immigration. I mean, one thing is that I'm going to say Mexicans, but you should say Hispanics because South American, Central American a lot, but it's primarily, they've kind of saved our demographics, because if we didn't have that inflow, we wouldn't have any young people. And so with your demographics in Europe is screwed. They don't have any. And you know, the other place is China. You know, China had the one boy rule. They messed with Mother Nature, which you can't fix. They're trying to bus girls in. You see that? I mean, are they going to bus 1,000 in? No. You need 300 million of them bussed in. But the demographics really matter. I think immigration, if our birth rate is going to slow down, and we have to have some kind of mix where we have babies, or you don't have enough workers to retired people. And by the way, ours, you know, what you really need is 4-1, and now we're a little less than 3, and it's going to get to 2. That's bad. China hits that wall now faster than we do because of the one baby rule. They're already there. But demographics are so important, because once you get that ratio wrong, you can't get the GDP high enough and enough jobs for the young people to be sending. Even if you cut Social Security down, you can't be sending enough money. By the way, we have to do something with immigration. I sat on a very nerdy day and figured out how many people really made that big technology run. It's only about 1,000. You can't get past 1,000. Of the 1,000, 60% of them weren't from America. It's so important. By the way, most of them were Indians, not Chinese or Japanese. So when you say immigration, I always say, which one are you talking about? Are you talking about millions for a new mix, or are you talking about the freaks of nature that when they wake up somewhere in Bangalore or Delhi or wherever it might be and say, I got to get to America? Boy, we need that beacon on as bright as we can so we can always have the best inventors and entrepreneurs headed here. So that's real important.
All right, one last question. What'd you say, 61 years old? You still have a lot of years left to really do something great. Do you want to be chairman of the Fed or president of the United States?
I don't think I'm actually qualified for the one I had, so I'm going to keep trying to make this work.
All right.
Thank you very much.
And please don't forget The Girl at United, Gate F4, and a great book. He talks about sustainable jobs that we need, not government-created jobs.
And Jim, thank you for being here again. We do have a couple of books for you to memorialize.